Good day, and you are listening to a special podcast from beatthechip.blogspot.com. I am on the line with Li Tian of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, here to discuss and comment on recent actions in Washington revolving around the PASS Act. Welcome to the podcast, Li.
Hi. Nice to be here, Sheila.
So I really appreciate you making time for this. There is a lot going on in Washington. We have an upcoming Senate committee hearing, the first in how long?
Almost, in a sense, really since Real ID was enacted, since there weren't any hearings on Real ID in the first place. And so there hasn't been a whole lot of public discussion.
Wow. So this is really a new precedent, the fact that we are having a hearing as a precedent. And this is the first hearing possibly ever to discuss repealing Real ID, of all things. Do you think we're making progress?
There might have been something along the way, but nothing big, nothing that would have made a difference. I mean, politically, Real ID has been sort of a third rail kind of thing since it was enacted, because it's got these big immigration-related things in it, as well as national ID. It's been very, very both controversial and painful, and at the same time politically entrenched. So it's an odd mix of factors that has made Real ID such a big pain for people who care about civil liberties.
So let me ask you an important question. Is the Real ID Act a decent legislation? I'm sure you deal with legislation all the time. Is it good legislation? Is it bad legislation? You know, somewhere in the middle, and why do you feel that way?
Well, Real ID from the start was a deeply, deeply flawed piece of legislation, and for a number of reasons. First of all, it got no scrutiny and was sort of cobbled together because of a very powerful Congressman, Sensenbrenner, and it got stuck in with no hearings, and it's a hodgepodge. If you read the bill, if you read the legislative history, which I have, you see it's just a mess. It wasn't well thought out. And at the same second, you know, even if it had been well thought out, what it tries to do, the part that we're focusing on here, is to create a national ID system. Now, true, some people will think, yeah, the driver's licenses of the states are already sort of like a de facto national ID, but really they're not pulled together. They're not integrated. They're still 50 moving parts, and each state had, without Real ID, you know, pretty much control over what it wanted to do. Under Real ID, everything was supposed to march in lockstep together, very standardized forms, standardized documents, database that would be shared across the states, really a massive ID and tracking system to be built up. So, you know, Real ID is a problem both because of what it was seeking to do and then how poorly it was trying to actually accomplish that.
So when we think about this legislation and what it seeks to do, is it actually performing or is it redundant?
Well, it's sort of worse than that. I mean, it's hard for people, I think, to wrap their heads around what a boondoggle Real ID is, because you know, they want to, there are some things that aren't so bad, like trying to make your driver's licenses more tamper-resistant, harder to counterfeit. You know, that's not really a civil liberties issue. On the other hand, putting in really, really costly document verification systems, requiring all sorts of identity verification, that's really a painful, painful thing that has not gone over well at all, not to mention that it's incredibly expensive. For instance, California, which is where EFF is based, you know, for years the DMV has been developing a very sophisticated, you know, online renewal system over the web, right? You know, renew your driver's license. You know, you can't do that when under a real ID system. You have to come in personally. There's all sorts of showing documents, et cetera, et cetera. It's the sort of thing that's would create the most ridiculous lines in sort of in DMV history in California. And, well, you know, that's already something that's not a good thing. So there's a lot of different issues related to how real ID would work. And, you know, what we thought over the past is, you know, a lot of the systems that they want to use for verification don't even exist. Try and verify Social Security numbers. Try to verify birth dates. What Real ID did was say there were going to be all these requirements, and then that they were requirements for things that didn't exist. And the last time that DHS was doing its regs, it basically had to admit, yeah, we don't have that system. We don't have that system. There's a whole bunch of vaporware, but, you know, so we're going to extend out the deadline and try to make these things, make sure that these things exist so that when we can, you know, so that we can make this all sort of happen. But it's really, really a big, chaotic mess. DHS estimated it was going to cost, you know, billions of dollars. No one is sure how much it's going to cost. It looks to me, and to a lot of groups, like a huge waste of money.
Yeah, I hear that. You know, I wish we could throw Real ID out based on pre-existing conditions. The fact that, you know, there wasn't any kind of, there's no end to it. It's the same reason why insurance companies don't take on certain patients with mysterious sicknesses that cannot be diagnosed. There's so much wrong with the Real ID Act that it seems like no matter how much you put into it, it's like dealing with a tar baby. You just get more involved and more bogged down.
Right. I mean, you know, that's why, you know, we, on the one hand, there are some things that you could fix, but overall, we think that it's so screwed up that, you know, it's just a mess, and the best way to deal with it, if people are serious about dealing with it, is not to try to paper over, not to use that framework at all, and then try to paper it in with, you know, duct tape and chewing gum or whatever, and try to, okay, this is just broken, scrap it, and start over. I mean, you know, there's some point where instead of building on rooms to a house or trying to do a remodel, you tear the thing down and put it on a foundation that's actually sensible. Now, having said all that, that doesn't mean that we support a national ID system at all. I mean, the prospect of a national ID system is itself a problem. But if there are goals that we can articulate for, say, a more secure ID system, you know, then, you know, let's deal with that and figure out how it can be done without violating people's privacy, without violating people's civil liberties.
So here's something I want to ask you about specifically, which is how credible or how plausible is the argument that these technologies, the radio frequency ID, the one-to-many uses of biometric DNA laminates, iris scans, fingerprints, facial recognition technology, which is the most prolific, of course. How relevant is that and how plausible is it to being imported for use in contemporary surveillance and increasing that surveillance in America?
Well, great question, Sheila. I mean, that's, you know, quite apart from the whole idea of a national ID system. The other thing that Real ID has been, as you were essentially pointing out, it's been a vehicle. It's been something that a lot of folks in, you know, sort of the security industrial complex have, or surveillance industrial complex, which is really the way that some of my friends would put it. They've been loading this Real ID initiative up with all of these technologies that will make it easier to conduct surveillance throughout society. And I have to say that it's the events of the last 5 years have shown us, really, that these things are getting quite a foothold. Here in California, we deal with RFID. We have been dealing with a proposal by our state DMV to use facial recognition in scanning when it scans images for driver's licenses. All of these things have been pushed by Real ID, the Real ID legislation. And in fact, one of the most specific things that we are worried about with Real ID or Pass ID is the Pass ID is going to ratify, which it already is, the practice of these enhanced driver's licenses. Mm. Now, the enhanced driver's licenses are driver's licenses that kind of look like your ordinary driver's licenses, but they have long range, like 30-foot range RFID chips built into them. And these were originally sort of put in order to comply with the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative for folks in states that are near the border. If you want to cross into Canada, you want to cross into Mexico, you live in the state of Washington, you live in Michigan, these are things that a lot of people do every day. The law changed to say you couldn't just do this, you couldn't do this without a passport. And then they said, well, but we'll let you get a cheaper passport called a pass card, or better yet, some states will get to have these enhanced driver's licenses with the RFID chips in them, and we'll let you use those as IDs for border crossings here in North America. So that's how they incentivize states and people to accept this RFID technology, and now this is going to become sort of a part of the Real ID system, and it's a very, it's a pretty obvious, overt way to try to get more of this tracking technology into people's wallets. So I would say that it's a real threat. It's not just a threat, it's actually been happening. It's going to happen even if we were able to, deal with, I think, the Pass ID, Real ID, Washington legislation, simply because it's very, very, it's something that the companies who are making money off of RFID or off of facial recognition.
Now let me break in. Lee, can you explain why RFID is not a secure technology? And we know here in Texas that it has failed the U.S. visit program. It has been tested and it failed based on adoption rates. And what they're using it for, the proposed use, is to expedite traffic at the border. But you would have to have an absolute adoption rate of the RFID technologies for everybody and anybody who was crossing over the Texas border. And which means that if there was one person in the car who didn't have the RFID technology, the vehicle would have to be stopped, and then it's not expediting. It's not expediting at that point.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you hit it in a nutshell, and what you also pointed out is something that's shared with the whole sort of ID situation, right? It's pretty hard to have anything like a voluntary national ID system or a voluntary ID system that separates, say, the people who are Americans from immigrants, because in order to make those kinds of systems work, everyone's got to have one. Now, the RFID issue, there are so many dimensions to those privacy and civil liberties issues with RFID. First of all, but the most important is simply that RFID is a technology that allows information, whether it's just an ID number or your name and your photograph, to be basically sucked out of the card or the credential without necessarily your having any knowledge or control of it. I used to tell people here in California, look, you want to put an RFID tag into the driver's license that has my name, my address, all that other kind of information. Well, I've got a daughter. She's 16. She's about to get a driver's license. Do I want her walking around with a card that tells anyone with a reader what her name is, where she lives, et cetera, et cetera? I don't think so. The simple point of it is, the government should not be in the business of putting technology into our wallets or our purses that is going to really expose our information to other people. That's irresponsible. It's creating privacy problems. It's creating security problems. Now, in some cases, you might be able to shield it, but still, I would always say, look, you can't create a problem and then say, okay, people, there are these ways that you might be able to solve it. Again, that's just irresponsible. The other thing is that it's possible, even if there isn't any information like your name on it, which is the situation with the enhanced driver's licenses, it's still got a unique ID number. That means you're always going to be giving off, if I have one of those, I'm always going to be giving off this number. Maybe it's 77596. But that's going to be me, whether I'm at the mall, whether I'm at a toll plaza, whether I'm at the border. And so someone with a reader who otherwise doesn't know me can have a network of readers that track that number, 77596, wherever it is. Now, that means you need a ubiquitous reader network, but, as we've seen with some of these car tagging situations here in the Bay Area, again, we've got a network of sensors in the roads that are already sort of picking up the fast track transponder numbers, and so it's not really far fetched to think of the possibility of these kinds of devices emitting unique ID numbers that will allow people to be tracked.
That's just, it seems so comprehensive for a world or international identity. Lee, this Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative seems to be this kind of like shadowy, removed, untouchable force outside of the bounds of, congressional legislation. It seems to have imported itself almost like a virus or a hitchhiker of some sort outside of the, due process of legislation. Now, they propose an initiative at a national level, and then an agency like DHS will adopt it. Can you explain what you know about the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative and why it's shaping the demand for biometric identity, especially in a legislation like Real ID or the PASS Act?
Well, Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative I think the best way to sort of explain that is to think back to 9/11. A lot of the problems we're talking about today really have their roots in 9/11.
Okay, so I'm going to stop you there. I'm going to stop you there because the 9/11 Commission's recommendations are of a real high consideration where Real ID Act is involved, even though it's an absolute mess. They want to hang on to it due to 9/11 Commission considerations. Continue.
Yeah, and really the 9/11 Commission didn't go as far as I don't approve of the 9/11 Commission's with respect to a lot of what they were, a lot of the recommendations in this area, but even if you take them on their word, they did not go as far as what Real ID did. But in any case, a lot of things happened after 9/11, and it was Congress getting a lot of folks in Congress and also in the agencies. They all wanted to appear like they were doing something to improve our nation's security. I'm sure they all wanted to improve our nation's security. And it was a time when if you objected to that for any kind of ground or any kind of reason, you were shouted down. It was difficult for folks in the privacy and civil liberties area to really effectively oppose things after 9/11 that were bad for civil liberties. The Patriot Act is probably the best example, but Real ID is part of that, and the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative is part of that, because there was we created the whole Department of Homeland Security as a result, right? It didn't exist before 9/11. When you create a department that's all about Homeland Security, well, they're going to spend a lot of time thinking up how to do stuff on security, and not necessarily, and this is the government again, so it's not necessarily going to be smart, it's not necessarily going to be well thought out, And how much is Congress going to really be overseeing something like that? So the Western Hemisphere travel initiative is this idea that, part of the general idea of we've got to harden our border, our documents, right? Remember, after 9/11, one of the big issues was, the hijackers got into the country with fake IDs, et cetera, et cetera. And so hardening identification became a really, really big issue in Washington. And WHITI, as we call it, the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, is a big part of that. But, there's an important point here, Sheila, that I think we all have to remember. This isn't just about the government. In fact, in many ways, it's much bigger than what governments do or don't want to do. A lot of this, you have to simultaneously look not just at the governments, but at the big multinational corporations, the industries that see, hey, pots and pots of money will come pouring into our coffers if we are working on stuff that has Homeland Security on the first page. And what kind of stuff is going to do that? It's metal detectors at airports. It's explosive detectors. It's biometrics. It's RFID. We're going to be able to say all of these shiny new technologies that have languished until now, if you give us billions and billions of dollars, we'll be able to put these into action and be able to make our country safer. And, if you think about your typical politician, are they going to be able to actually think straight about that sort of stuff? No, they're not. And
well, let me break in, because we only have about 4 or 5 more minutes. I want you to be as directive as you can. Does Real ID actually make us safer? With all of the things that they call for, all of the huge price tag attached that we have to foot, does it achieve the end goal?
No, I don't think Real ID makes us safer. Absolutely not. I mean, I think that it's really a colossal waste of money.
There you go. Well, I think that pretty much says it in a nutshell. You got to scrap it. This Real ID Act is not fixable. It doesn't achieve the ends of national security. It's supposed to be a national security enforcement, and everything about it is not functioning in that direction. What recommendations would you give to DHS if you had the whole panel in front of you and could say it today? What would you tell them?
I would tell them to completely repeal the existing Real ID law, and I would tell them not to enact anything to replace it, but rather to actually step back, look at what we've learned over the last several years, and start working out a real plan, if they want to do this, still want to do this, of how to make it work, learning from all the lessons we've had. Bring in the states, bring in privacy and civil liberties advocates, bring in experts, and address the problem as though it were a serious substantive problem and not as though it were a piece of political theater. That's what I would tell them.
And what of the vendors? Because the vendors have made themselves very self-important in this, very self-important, even threatening suit if states don't comply.
Well, vendors are, really a, it's like anything. You can't get anything done without the companies. And in many ways, the companies are the ones that know the truth about whether the technology works, how the systems work. So I don't want to bash them as because they are, in fact, doing what is rational economically for them to do. If we were big profit-making corporations, we would be trying to make a profit. The problem is the system gives them an enormous amount of power. They tell, they know a lot. They don't tell us, folks like you and me, what the facts are. They don't even necessarily tell the government. you know, what the facts are. But they will put on the best show for them and say, this will solve your problems. And then once they get a contract, they will hope that they can solve their problems. But as we've seen in the defense industries, in the military industrial complex, there's a lot of less than completely honest dealing going on. I remember several years ago, I was called by the government accountability office to talk to and work with them on biometrics for border control. And what I saw was a lot of government agencies struggling with a congressional mandate to incorporate biometrics into border control in this country. Congress had been convinced that this was one of the big answers was to use fingerprint verification or face recognition or something at the airports to make sure that people were properly screened. And so then they put that into law, and then agencies like the State Department of Homeland Security and so forth were actually supposed to do something with it. And when the rubber met the road, when they were actually starting to do this, and you talked about this a little bit, Sheila, you know, trying to come up with systems that would actually, you know, work for screening people at the border, man, they had massive, massive problems. And what I heard over and over again is, well, it sounded good, but, you know, once we got out of the laboratory and once we got into the field, it was much, much harder to do anything about it. And yet, this was the agencies, right? They've already been given, it's just like, you know, your boss has told you what to do. Once you have an assignment, you can't decide that assignment's not a good idea. You have to do it. So you get this situation of sort of a separation of a reality where the Congress gives you orders, the agencies fumble with it if it's not really a smart order, and, you know, real ID is kind of in the same situation. DHS, you know, when I talk to those folks at DHS, they haven't been happy with real ID, the folks who are actually working on those rules. But, you know, it's above their pay grade at DHS to change real ID. That's one of the reasons why I don't excoriate and condemn and deride the folks at DHS a lot of times when it comes to trying to do these regulations, because much of the blame has to be laid at the feet of Congress and the President for, you know, crafting and passing and signing bad bills. Once that bad bill is in there, you know, the agency can't just sort of nullify it. Here, you've just got a huge problem, though, and I think there's no way to do it other than for Congress to go back and say, we made a mistake.
Well, it's okay to make mistakes sometimes, but this is a mistake we really literally can't afford. And it won't do what, even in a good day, in a good light, it still won't do what it portends to perform as. And so I really appreciate your time, Li Tian of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, discussing the PASS Act and Real ID. Do you have any parting shots on the PASS Act?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, there's a hearing coming up next week in the Senate, and I'd like to encourage all of your listeners to reach out to either their senators or representatives, but in particular, if they've got any senators or representatives on the Homeland Security committees of the House or Senate, to let them know that Real ID is a mess, that PASS ID isn't going to make it better, and that what they really need to do is to scrap the system. I think we need people to remind Congress that we care about these national ID systems and the virulent surveillance technologies that they want to foster. Right now, there's a lot of concern in Congress about other things, big issues, of course. You know, the economy, healthcare, what's going on all over the world, nuclear proliferation. They've got a lot on their plate. But, you know, that makes it really easy for them to forget that we care about these other things, and it makes it easy for the supporters of PASS ID or Real ID to say, hey, look, people don't really care about this stuff. If you pass this, let this stuff go, it's not going to hurt you politically. We have to remind them that it actually does matter to us.
Thank you very much. Li Tian of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, you've been listening to beatthechip.org.